This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, and we get to meet them each time. The idea to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure do learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you missed the last episode, you can find it online at hometownheroesradio.com. There's more than 350 episodes there for you. We heard Tom Rice of Coronado, California, explaining how he became a paratrooper with the 101st Airborne in World War II. When we left off, it was June 6th, 1944, D-Day, and he had parachuted behind enemy lines. It was still the middle of the night, and he had knocked on a Frenchman's door and gotten a little better idea of where he was.
We got through with that, went out on the road again with three of us, walking in the ditch real low, and a lieutenant ahead of me yelled, "Hey, Sergeant, come here." Now, he was standing at a large gate where cattle would go in and come out, and it was a pasture field in there. He was standing there and said, "Sergeant, I want you to walk around this field on the edge. I'm going to stay right here and wait." He had a carbine rifle, a short one, with a metal stock on it. This guy was bound to, had it in his mind, he's going to get a sniper. I'm a bait.
Thanks a lot.
I knew it was exactly what he was doing, so I walked that perimeter 600 and some yards, and I had my trigger finger ready to go, and I had that submachine gun up, you know, looking into the trees. Mm-hmm. I got back to the point where he set me off. He was gone. I learned a couple things. Never arrive at your point of departure as a final destination, because they could have seen it, could have watched me. 50-some years later, New York staff writer called, wanting to come out and interview me. He took 100 pictures of me for all what reason, I don't know. Then he started asking questions. And on the question period, he asked me to explain some heroism. I said they were all heroes. And then it hit me. I'll explain what happened right there. And I told him what happened, what that lieutenant did. I said, "This is a situation of cowardice. They printed that story. They printed my picture with it. And I hope that son of a gun saw it."
If he made it through the war.
If he made it, yeah. I figured this guy's going to get somebody killed. But so we wandered around there, out in fields, and a horse was had been hit with shrapnel. A medic I had with me, Robert Schill, he patched him up with sulfadiazone, and we used the horse as a protection to get to some other point. Went into a house, searching the houses, and I crossed a window, and I had a rifle shot come through for the sniper. It hit just in front of me and caught me in the leg. It was a hard, like I was hit like a baseball bat almost, you know. So I could pull the pant leg up and pulled it out and put it in my pocket. I never know what happened to it after that.
So this is your first day.
Yeah.
And you're already hit.
First day. This is June 6th.
And you've already got a wound in your leg.
Yeah, I got a wound that I didn't pay too much attention to. It didn't bother me that much, crying out loud. I'm not going to medic and say, "Give me a Purple Heart or make a record of this baloney." But I've known lieutenants who've done that.
Sure.
But we began to hook up with some of the guys. And on the road, we found maybe 15 or 20 of them. Major Allen was there. He organized us into a small group, put our packs down, drop our packs, don't take anything else with you except your ammunition. We're heading toward La Barquette Lock. Now, the set of locks there. And the Germans closed the locks to flood the entire area.
Right.
The locks were closed. We were going to open them. Now, by the time the locks were opened and the water flowed out and drained into the English Channel, the battle would have been miles beyond it. So I figured, this is a phony, crazy, stupid objective. But we went down there, and we ran into the 6th German Parachute Infantry Regiment. They were 3,000 in strength. The battalions were in two or three different places. One was in Perrier, and they were having a good time. They were having a party. And a messenger came in and said, "They're coming, they're coming." The aircraft were coming in. They weren't bombarding yet, but he heard all these aircraft coming, and the parachutes are dropping. In the British zone, they dropped dummy parachutes with explosives on them. So when they hit the ground, the explosive went to attract all the Germans over there. So things were pumping on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So Colonel Heidi, who was the commanding officer there, he got these guys organized. One battalion was to go to the beach.
And we're talking about the German forces.
Yeah,
now. Colonel
German
Heidi
forces.
Was with, the, right, with
yeah.
the German forces.
See, they were 300 feet above us.
Uh-huh. And you said 3,000 strong. How many do you think were with you?
It was 50.
3,000 versus 50?
50. Well, not quite yet. They were broken into three battalions.
Okay.
And the battalion, one battalion was to go to the beachhead and to get in between us and the landing forces to disrupt that landing.
Right.
We met them at a place called Penemy. Their second battalion evidently was a little bit north, but near the beach, they were coming south. Rifles slung on their shoulder. Did you see Saving Private Ryan?
Sure.
You remember these guys taken out with that captain looking for Private Ryan, smoking cigarettes and rifles slung?
Yep.
These Germans were singing their national anthem and
wow.
whatnot. Going toward Carentan, another battalion was in another opposite direction, some distance from them, going to W4, which was a blockhouse. They had Goliaths there with 200 pounds of dynamite on little automatic wheelbarrow kind of thing, and they would control them by radio, and they wanted to get those things in there to blow up any of the American forces that were coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But when the guys did come in, the W-4 had been knocked out, and these crazy little machines were running around. The guys would go up to them, put hand grenades on them, and then back off. And that's what would. But anyway, we got into a big battle with maybe 400 Germans.
And this is, now we're hearing why you said earlier that you had the worst possible drop.
Yeah.
So there's 50 of you, there's 400 Germans.
400 Germans.
And it's still dark?
No, it's light.
The sun has come up. It's the morning of June 6th.
Yeah.
And what do you have personally to use against the enemy?
My Thompson submachine gun.
Uh-huh.
But on the way down to La Barquette Lock, three of us were ordered to go to the lock and outpost it. So I didn't get to Penemy, which was maybe 300 yards from me. I was at La Barquette Lock, so we outposted it that night. We figured some of the Germans in Carentan are going to come down on patrols,
mm-hmm.
whatnot. 400 of them are in battle with 50 Americans. We captured them all.
Wow.
Amazing. Captured them all. So we set up that night because I figured certainly there's going to be some Germans coming down finally trying to find out what's going on. I set up about six stakes. I set wire between the stakes. We hung wire from the stakes vertically and tied tin cans on them. In the tin cans, I put bolts and nuts and all kinds of things. I mean, it's a silly thing, but it's kind of creative there.
Mm-hmm.
So any patrol coming through has to come down that way. And he's not going to be able to see that because it's so dark and the metal is dark and it's kind of low. He's going to trip on it. 2 o'clock in the morning, patrol came through. I was situated right in the corner. The orchard is long leg and the short leg. I was right in the corner of the short leg. The other two guys were on the long leg. And we were tied together, wrist to wrist, with parachute suspension line. If any noise or anything you hear comes through there, you're alerted for some reason. We stayed 2 hours on and then slept. We alternated that. Just jerked those cords. And we just start shooting out there. German patrol came through. We got one of them. He might have been his only man. I'm not sure. Can't prove it. But he was out there, and he moaned all night long. One of the guys had experience as working in a mortuary, so he took his trench knife and went out there and finished him off. And so we pulled him in the morning. We dug a trench for him in the orchard, and We cut some limbs off the tree and made a cross out of it. I still have his parachute wings, cloth wings. I hid them on my shoe, so if I ever captured with those things, boy, I'd be in real trouble. One of the other incidents that took place there is the Catholic chaplain set up an aid station close to where I landed. And there were some guys that were pretty seriously wounded. Some of them were hysterical. And the Germans were coming in that direction. They did penetrate the aid station, and they were looking for weapons. If they found weapons in that aid station, that would have been the end of that aid station. But they took the captain's Samson, Catholic clergyman, marched him down the road. There's plenty of evidence on this. They put him up against a wall with a firing squad. He had his helmet on with a Christian cross on it, so they knew. And a German officer came down the road wearing a Christian cross on a necklace. He saw that and stopped it.
Wow.
Amazing. And they conversed a little bit as best they could, showing that they're both clergymen, whatever, you know. But ultimately, you go, Father Samson, he got out of that one, but he was captured in Bastogne, and he was a prisoner of war for the rest of the war.
Wow.
But anyway, we got together again, and after 37 days of doing all this maneuvering, and a battle took place at St. Marie de Mont, which was a key city. We gathered together at an area, spread up some parachutes in the trees, and they had an investigation on the pilots. We gave testimony on the pilots. Nothing ever came of it, of course. Nothing.
There were some more urgent matters taking place,
right,
huh?
Yeah, so we went back to England. Mm-hmm. The first guys that went back to England were the wounded, and then the band. And so when we landed in England, the band was playing. So we got 10-day furloughs.
You mentioned that there was a battle at Marie de Mont. How were you involved in it?
I was still at the La Barquette Locks.
So you're still guarding the locks?
Still involved there June 7th at the locks.
Uh-huh.
But some of the guys that did gather together were at St. Côme de Mont, and they were trying to defend that. That was a hot battle there.
Looking back, are you thankful that they sent you to the lock, even though you didn't see the reason for it?
If we had been away from the lock, we would have been at St. Marie de Mont.
And there were plenty of guys that were wounded there, I'm sure.
Yeah,
and I know that you'd be wounded more later, but I'm just curious, because you shared that you didn't get the significance of, you know, that it wouldn't have mattered with the lock, whether it was open or closed, but that's where you were. And it turned out that was a pretty good place for you to be, right?
It was a safer place than at the battle, because this battalion of Germans were coming down on them, and the guys had their submachine guns and their 30 caliber and their bazookas ready. The Germans were crossing the canals. They let them come within maybe two canals of them, and they got itchy, and they opened fire. The Germans went to the ground. A number of them were wounded. So Colonel Johnson and two German-speaking American paratroopers went out with a white flag to contact the officer in charge, and he came forward, and he told him to surrender. He said, it's too early in the day to surrender. Too early in the day. So he didn't make any points there, so he went back, and on his way back, he was fired on. Then the guys opened fire on him.
Wow.
They killed a lot of them. He went back out the second time, told him, the officer, to tell the wounded to put their bayonets on their rifles, put the rifle in the ground, put their helmet on top of their bayonet. Then we'll come out. Let's have a truce.
Yeah.
They did. They organized a truce. They picked up the Germans, and none of us got hit. But picked up some of the Germans and gave them first aid as best they could.
Wow.
So we go back to England.
Yeah.
We had 18 parachute drops put in front of us on paper all over France, and mainly France. Most of those, almost all of them, failed. We would go to the airport, parachute up, no ammunition. When they didn't give us ammunition, then I knew we weren't going in.
Right.
So we'd go back. So these were just kind of training things back and forth. 17 failed, and the last one was Market Garden.
So 17 times you got on a plane with them saying this is a jump, and it wasn't.
Well, let's qualify that. We got orders to do it, but not all the times we went to the airport. The front line was kind of staggering, losing and gaining. And so the orders were not fulfilled. But we got the orders to be ready. Mm-hmm. But a couple of them, we did go to the airport.
So Market Garden would be your next jump. And there's a lot that's been written about this. As much as D-Day is celebrated for the overall success, Market Garden in the big picture was not a success. It was disastrous.
Yeah.
How did you experience it?
I made a nice jump at 1,200 feet. I kept going up. I'm wondering why I'm going up. Evidently, I'd hit some thermals or something. I was going up and drifting. I kept reaching for legs. I was talking to myself, we got to get down, got to get down. Well, about 300 feet, I was coming over a thatched house.
This is in Holland?
Yeah, this is in Holland. I jumped number one again.
Mm-hmm.
We came in a nice formation. we were on the wrong drop zone. Then there was a drop zone A1 further down. He missed A, didn't recognize anything. We jumped on A1, and I was coming down at a couple hundred feet, trying to find out where I was going to land. Now, it looks to me like I'm going to land on this house. So I started maneuvering the risers, got away from that. But the next thing I saw at 50 feet was steel picket fence line around a cabbage patch right next to the house. They were pointed like the ones out here. I'm going to land on one of those.
Ouch.
So I just went whole hog on the risers and slipped into the cabbage patch, hit the cabbage patch. I was okay. My submachine gun jammed into the mud. It's not useful right now unless I clean it up. The only thing I worried was, how am I going to get out of this thing, get out of that fence line, if there's enemy around, because I couldn't defend myself. Mm. But I got out of there okay.
That was the only weapon you had? You didn't have a 45 or anything?
No, I didn't
have. Just the submachine gun?
The 506 got the 45s. There weren't enough 45s around for all of us. Uh-huh. But what some of the guys did, they stole the 45s from the pilots.
Smart move.
Yeah. Or they stole it from some officer.
Sure.
So anyway, here we are off the drop zone, 10 kilometers from Vegel, V-E-G-H-E-L, which we're supposed to hold. We're supposed to hold the bridges and the railroad overpasses. The guys began to accumulate and going down the main highway, and the Dutch people were out on the side of the road with gingerbread and Calvados. And that Calvados is potent stuff because it's an apple country.
Mm-hmm.
And the gingerbread was 1 inch square and about 2 feet long. Great big long things like that. They were giving that to us, wanted to talk to us. We got into Vegel, and all of the people in the city were in the city square, and they were just milling around. There was thousands of people, and there was a lot of spies in there because one woman came up, and how many Americans are dropped?
Huh.
Oh, I said, 500,000.
If only that were the truth, that operation might have gone a little better. When we come back, we'll hear Tom's memories of that prolonged battle, as well as the twist of fate that cut short his time fighting in the Battle of the Bulge. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting again with 93-year-old Tom Rice of Coronado, California, a recipient of the Bronze Star and the Purple Heart while serving with the 101st Airborne 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment during World War II. When we left off, he had jumped into the Netherlands as part of the ill-fated Operation Market Garden in the fall of 1944. If you've read the book A Bridge Too Far or seen the movie of the same name, you know about Operation Market Garden. Let's get back to how Tom experienced it 70 years ago.
We went into Erde, Scheindel. We went up to a place called Coffin Corner, up where the dike meets the bridge that goes into Arnhem. It was occupied by the Scottish Black Watch Regiment. They were a real good regiment, and they had their equipment in there. And the night of October 4th, we went into Driel and replaced them. They marched out of there with their bagpipes going and their national anthem.
Huh.
That was a tough place. We were in a tough spot there. We were surrounded again. So we figured, since we're surrounded again, it sounds like the same old story. So what are we going to do? Attack. So there's battles up and down the dike all the time. We threw hand grenades over the dike, hoping that they would get caught and go into the trenches where the Germans were. Some didn't. Some rolled all the way down. So then we tied nylon string on them and threw them over, pulled them up a little bit where we thought. And the Germans were throwing hand grenades at us. It was a crazy battle.
Yeah, well, and you can laugh about it now, but I'm sure it was no laughing matter at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And how close was enemy artillery, enemy bullets, enemy hand grenades? How close were they coming to you?
Not too close, because I was back a little bit with the mortar. I was back maybe 50 yards, but I knew it was happening. There was a gap in the dike. They ran a German tank back and forth there every night, making all the noise you could possibly, squeaking, and you know how tank tracks would go. Mm-hmm. All the noise possible, trying to just keep us awake and uneasy. Then that tank tried to break through that gap. One of the guys ran over to a British 6-pound artillery piece, threw a shell in it, and started hitting every lever he could. It fired. It set part of the ammunition up toward the bridge, and it hit a little guardhouse. It was about 2x2, whether it was a guy in there or not, no. And he saw that, and he lowered the thing, and he put another one in it, and he fired that thing, and it hit their tank. He stopped the tank from coming through. In the meantime, a guy was running along the side of the dike. He put a bazooka shell into the tank. So the argument now is, who did it? Who stopped the tank?
Who gets the credit?
Who gets the Silver Star?
Yeah.
That's what it was.
That's what it came down to.
Yeah, the guy that shot the guy on our side, named Frank Carpenter, he got the Silver Star for shooting that 6-pounder at the tank. Because they couldn't prove this one guy was all by himself. We all the rest of us saw that.
What do you think would have happened if the tank wasn't stopped?
It'd have gotten inside of our perimeter. We'd have stopped it.
But it would have cost you some lives.
It might have cost us. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we were there at the called the island for 3 months under the British Second Army under General Montgomery. Hated the guy.
Why?
Because we weren't supposed to be there. He just refused to release us.
Mm-hmm. And it was day after day of battle?
Yeah. Rain. There was a Polish group of battalion of Polish jumpers jumped in there, and they gave him the worst possible objectives. And General Wiebrowski, he knew it. He hated Montgomery and told us so. So there was a lot of animosity there. Gave him the worst jump possible. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the Polish were killed, you know, which was maybe 4 days after Market Garden had already developed.
Right. So, as day after day of this goes by, do you get more used to it? Do you start to get numb to the sights and the sounds and the smells and the fact that you're probably losing buddies? How did you handle that?
Ran patrols from the dike out. Maybe a mile or 3/4 mile out into the flooded area to a brick factory. We had a couple of guys there in a brick factory in the chimney watching the Germans across. Mm-hmm. We ran patrols out, but the Germans had filtered into that flatland too, so we were running into them. Not many of them, but a few. We were also observed from the railroad track, which was about 60 feet above us on a very steep slope, because we were in a big barn. We had British 10-in-1 rations, and we hated all the peas and carrots, so we lined the rafters with cans of peas and carrots and ate all the rest of it. We were back and forth near. The Germans observed my mortar position. They threw in some mortar rounds on it, and they didn't knock out the gun, but they destroyed my ammunition.
So where were you?
I don't know at that moment where I was.
Good thing you weren't there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good thing I wasn't there. I took a bazooka and got back from the dike a little bit. There was a 3-story house right next to the dike on the German side with windows from floor to ceiling. I put a bazooka round right through the window and exploded inside. So the guys were all laughing about that. I didn't get permission to do it.
But you knew it was German occupied.
Yeah, I knew it was occupied because they could see us.
Right.
I tied a rope on the gunny sack bag that I had with the ammunition that had been pelted and pulled it to see if it was going to explode. Because it was too dangerous to go in there and start handling it. It didn't. It was all right. So after Market Garden and 3 months there, we were sent to France. Reims, Marmelon, France. We had a furlough a few days before that. Instead of going to Venice and Marseille, I chose Paris. I climbed the northwest leg of the Eiffel Tower up to the first level. And the first level was a restaurant. You couldn't go any higher because of barbed wire.
Mm-hmm.
And,
you probably weren't supposed to climb that, were you?
No, we're supposed to do that.
What possessed you?
Yeah.
I noticed a painting of the Eiffel Tower in the corner here.
Yeah.
You just saw the Eiffel Tower and said, I'm going to go climb that. Did anyone yell at you?
It was big. It was there. There was gendarmes around, but be careful of the gendarmes because their capes, the edge of their capes were lined with lead. They swing a cape at you and that'll knock you down. You never expect that.
Uh-huh.
They had billy clubs. Your focus would be on that billy club, but not the cape.
But you must have been quick enough to get up before they could catch you, huh?
I got up to this first level and then came down. That was enough. We just had to do it.
Well, that sounds like your friend Louis Zamperini stealing that swastika flag in Berlin in 1936. So you get your R&R in Paris, and you have no idea that there's going to be something called the Battle of the Bulge, and you're going to be freezing your butt off at Bastogne before long, huh?
Yeah. They called us out of Paris and Reims. While we were there resting, our weapons were turned in that were damaged. Our clothing was dirty, stinking stuff. We had to wait for new clothing, clean clothing. So, see, we were fairly well depleted.
Mm-hmm.
And when the order came in to board those 40 and 8s, there's some things we didn't have. I had my submachine gun, but little, if any, ammunition. I didn't have a jacket. I had no gloves. I might have had a K-ration or two in my pocket. That's about it.
So you had no idea what you were getting into.
No, I didn't know where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
You know where we're going. We were going like a bat out of hell to get there, trucks, and with the lights way down, you know. And we got into Bastogne, and we got out of the trucks, and I saw on the streets, the main street, tanks after tank after tank, right up against the commercial buildings and the stores, all the guns pointing toward Germany, out of gas. The 106th Infantry Division guys were coming through, dragging their rifles, saying, they're coming. You be careful. Watch out. There's hordes of them. We took their guns and ammunition. We were headed toward Neffy and southeast. We were on the wrong track. Colonel Kennard got us on the wrong road, got that corrected. We headed out toward Neffy. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with that, all that territory, but on a hill there is called Martizan. There is a museum, and we settled in that area, but it's only a current museum. And we went down long hills, went to an area where there was a tree line. We were not supposed to go in and attack. We were told to set up a defense. On the way down that long slope, cordoned off with barbed wire, and it was a wheat stubble area, ground was semi-frozen. They saw us. They put in some artillery shells and mortars. The platoon sergeant got killed. We set up a defense line. No food now. This is December 19th. 22nd, I got some food, a big pancake made of potatoes, mashed potatoes, slapped in my hands. A guy came by, said, open your hand. He wham, put that in and thanked him. He said, wait, he put in some hot potatoes on top of that. So I just kept, I didn't eat them yet. I just kept to warm my hands and then saved some of it, put it in my pocket and say, we don't care, there's no germs on this. We're too tough for that, you know. To save some of it. The order came down to patrol out in front. There was two villages out there, Neff, N-E-F-F-E, and Margaret. They wanted me to patrol those. They sent me out on a patrol, I think with about six guys. We went down the long slope that we came to a fork in the road. Across this fork was a haystack. It was hard, brittle, had been there for years probably. So we came into that. The patrol zigzagged back and forth, slowed down and was able to speed up because of the barbed wire fence. You had to go across those. Well, they were watching us. Ground was covered with snow, and we were in khaki. I got to the fork of the road. Now, which one am I going to take? I had decided on this one. Over in this area, deep valleys and very high hills. Wouldn't call them mountains, but high hills. We're going to take this way to Neffy.
Away from the hills.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so I sent scout number one out, and scout number two was at the fork. I was back there. I sent number two 50 yards from scout number one, and I was at the fork. And I noticed up in front of me, machine gun bullets were hitting in the ditch we were in. I knew what was going to happen. Waiting for the rest of that patrol to come down, get in that ditch, move up the ditch, then they're going to fire on the backside of the patrol because they know we're going to back out of there and
right.
hurry. So I saw all the machine gun hitting up there. I told number two scout to call number one scout back. And when I did, I stood up. I knew the risk I was taking. They saw me, and I got a shot in the left leg just above the knee.
As soon as you stood up, they hit you?
Yeah. Hit me. They knew the number three man is going to be the leader.
Mm-hmm.
See? So number one is out there. We got him to come around and go this way. I got him in this direction before I was hit. Number two scout, I called it back to me. I said, give me a shot of morphine. I carried 18 syrettes of it in case of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
He just uncorked one and shot me in the arm with it, and I never felt pain at all from there.
How bad was your wound?
I had to test it to find out if it was broken bone. So I stood up again to test it and take a turn, sent number two over here, and as I turned, my arm came up like this, got one through the arm.
So first of all, you're standing up because you realize you might be taking your patrol into an ambush.
Yeah.
You needed to reroute them you guys might
die. I told
die.
Those guys, I'm going to get you in this, I'm going to get you out of this.
And you might have all died had you not done
yeah.
that. So you put yourself at risk, you get hit in the leg, then you're trying to figure out if your left femur is broken or not, so you stand up again and they hit you in the arm.
Hit me in the arm, because I turned this way.
Right.
I turned this way and it got me run right through the arm, dropped my machine gun, my helmet came off, and I spun a little bit, and the next one went right by my ear. I could hear it pop. That leg wasn't broken. I could feel the warmth of the blood in my boots. I hit that haystack and bounced off it because it was so brittle and frozen.
Yeah.
And I was there for hours. I told second scout, take him back, it's over. And so here I am out here, maybe a mile out into, what do we call it, no man's land, if you want to use that term, looking around waiting. The thing that scared me the most was they're going to set that haystack on fire.
So you sent them all back, so you're all by yourself?
I'm by myself.
You're by yourself,
yeah.
Wounded in
yeah.
two different places.
Yeah.
Bleeding, but you didn't feel pain because of the morphine.
No pain.
What's going through your mind? Did you think you were going to die right there?
No. I'm wondering if they're going to send a squad out and how quickly are they going to come out there after me?
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know that I was wounded.
The Germans didn't know.
They really didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But their objective was to break up that patrol.
Uh-huh.
And they did. The patrol was a disaster.
So you're hiding next to this haystack. Hopefully they don't send anything into that puts it ablaze.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So here I am looking up and down the road. How am I going to get back? I'm going to roll across the road and go the other direction. Meantime, a guy by the name of John W. Curtis, he was on the patrol. He volunteered to come out from another direction along the road up the ditch that was frozen over. And I saw him. So I rolled across the road and went into the ditch. I said, John, give me the butt of your rifle. So I took that with the left hand. He pushed and pulled with his feet. I pushed and pulled with my feet. And we went a half a mile up the ditch. Then he helped me get up to where the defense line was. There was a Jeep there. They put me on the Jeep and took me into Bastogne, into the nunnery. There was four Belgique Catholic nuns there. They were taking care of us. Now, I'm under a real state of shock. And the bladder was about ready to explode, you know. I couldn't do anything. The floor was covered with stretchers and guys occupying stretchers, all wounded. So we were there until Patton broke through.
Mm-hmm.
German prisoners, we put them in the attic.
You stayed in that convent until Patton
yeah.
got there.
Yeah, until uh-huh. they got there.
And was it all the nuns helping you? Were there American medical personnel there too?
When I came in, they put me on an operating table, great big makeshift thing. I said, Colonel, I'm hungry. He said, get that man a sandwich. So I got a jam and peanut butter sandwich eating while they ran a swab about that long with a big cotton ball in it right through the arm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that cleared all the broken bone.
Mm-hmm.
There's where it's healed.
Yeah.
And it went in here and came out here.
So when it hit your arm, it broke some of the bones, or shattered some of your forearm?
Yeah, broke about 4 inches of bones.
In your right arm.
In the right arm, and they ran that swab through there, and that kind of cleared it up, and they just maneuvered it around.
So while they're doing that, sticking this big swab through your broken arm and bloody arm, you're eating a sandwich.
Eating a sandwich.
Hey.
Then they put me on the stretcher, and then Patton broke through. Then they took me to the 121st Field Hospital. There was a nurse there.
Yeah.
This nurse was 6'1". She weighed 160 pounds.
Uh-huh.
She was a strong gal. So when I wanted to go to the bathroom, she sent a prisoner down to take me to the bathroom and back. When we got relief out of the 121st Hospital to go to Paris, she put a great big red ribbon on my neck like that, a big bow.
Yeah.
For some reason, she liked me.
I guess so.
Her name was Lieutenant Janice Van Hees. How pretty, I don't know. It's wartime. Every one of them is a beauty. So here I am. I'm taken to the American embassy in Paris. They couldn't keep me down. Stitches broke, got infected. Mm. I'm walking around. They decided I better go be sent to England. So with the red bow on it, I was put on a lighter in a baby crib, and the English seaman called me Little Lord Fauntleroy, teasing me. So here I am. I went to the American hospital in England. There was another guy in there by the name of Rice. And I'm going to go for operation. I went for 3 operations there. They fed me and starved him. I was supposed to go for operation, but they fed me, and I counted to 104 under sodium pentothal, and that's dangerous, because if I'd have thrown up, there's nothing they could have done.
Yeah.
I got through that one all right, but the nurse said, don't ever tell anybody what happened. I didn't.
So, of all the close calls, that may have been your closest, and it wasn't even the Germans that did it to you.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And he never shies away from those dangerous situations, not even at 93. When we come back, the rest of Tom's story, including what the self-described risk-taker does every year on June 6th. You won't find most 93-year-olds trying this. Photos of it at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping things up with the energetic Tom Rice. So hard to believe he's 93. But 70 years ago, at 23, he was in a hospital in Europe, healing from wounds suffered at the Battle of the Bulge. Let's pick things up where we left off.
So 2 or 3 weeks there at the hospital, and then they sent me to Repo Depot, a replacement, mm-hmm. where they channel these guys out to different places. So I took about 10 guys south to Birch's Garden. The war was winding down some now. And so I found a copy of Mein Kampf. It's done in rice paper, a hard copy. It's in silk. I still have it, and I put the date on it, May 28th, 1945.
Mm.
So we stayed in Birch's Garden. We got all of the Burgermeister and his council, told them to get in top hats and their regular formal attire. We gave them bristle brooms on with long handles, hot water and soap, made them scrub the cobblestones from the Berghof Hotel to the council chambers. I mean, that's creative.
There's a new sheriff in town.
Yeah, that's creative.
Uh-huh.
And then here we are. Guys are running wild. They were drinking. They found the liquor spots. No people, but they found a tremendous cache of wine. The officers let us go in and get some of that stuff, but no second chances. So the guys are out hunting and doing everything, and some German citizens got called and were killed. So there's some problems with that. So things were just kind of upset. Guys were running wild. We played softball. We played football. We swam in the lakes and did all that stuff. Then they introduced a point system. I think the qualifying number to get out was 79. I had 89 or 92. So they decided to deactivate. They deactivated the 501, and they decided the new recruits had low points. They're going to go to Germany in occupation. We're not going to do that. We've had enough of this stuff. So all our high pointers, we went home.
A couple more questions for you. VE Day. Big deal for you or no?
No. Although in Normandy, we were told with General Taylor standing on a bunker. You have defeated the enemy in such great style. We have more combat for you. Somebody started to boo. Mm-hmm. Now the regiment's out there.
Mm-hmm.
The division is out there.
Mm-hmm.
The booing picked up, and the old general was booed.
Wow. Nobody was dying to go to the Pacific.
No, sirree. We had that in our mind. It was probably going to get said.
Yeah.
You know. So, yeah. But it never materialized because they deactivated the 501, and the guys that were new, like I said, go to Germany for occupation.
What was the date when you were wounded?
December 22nd, about 2 p.m.
That brings a few things to mind. For one, Christmas must have been interesting for you that year.
It was Christmas in the convent floor because they had a little ceremony with the officers, you know, with a chopped down tree and made up some Christmas balls and things. And
what do you think of when it's Christmas, you're 23 years old, you're lying in a bed with a wounded leg and a wounded arm?
How am I going to get out of here? You know, I had 195 days of combat.
Yeah.
That's enough.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the guys had, well, maybe comparable. Combat is combat. We were in the most exclusive fraternity that occupies space on the face of the earth. That is a foot soldier and the airborne on patrol in enemy territory. That is a fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
There's not many guys in that.
No. And there were a lot that didn't get to come home.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were wounded in the first week of the Battle of the Bulge. It went on for a while after that. Is there a chance that being wounded when you did saved your life? I don't mean to minimize what you went through or the suffering that you experienced.
Yeah, who knows? That's just projection, and it may be a good possibility.
Because there are a lot of 101st Airborne guys who kept going after that. And who died.
They went on down to Alsace-Lorraine and did patrols into the Hurtigan Forest, and they did a lot of things there.
And you have a very unique way of honoring the guys that you served with, and especially those who didn't come home. Tell me how you got the idea to jump out of an airplane every June 6th.
Risk taker again.
Yeah.
Full of energy. I had 51 years of long distance running. There's got to be something else out there I can do.
Yeah.
You see? I had 44 years of high school and junior college teaching.
What'd you teach?
I taught U.S. government and U.S. history. And I never told anybody in the class about my activity in the 101st.
Wow.
Except once in page 476, chapter 24 in the history textbook. There was a picture of a lieutenant with, and I'm sure you've seen it, it's made a postage stamp out of it, with a piece of cardboard that's number 23 written on it, and a lot of guys around him, all of the guys trying to get eager to get into the conversation with General Eisenhower. And he was asking the lieutenant what his name was and what state he's from. He said, Michigan. He said, oh, yes, I've had some very fine fishing in Michigan. And so these guys tried to put him at ease. He was worried about us because he had a lot of propaganda. He said, 80% of you guys are going to get lost, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
Which put him at ease. Now, we're ready. We're ready, General.
So you were in the picture?
No.
But the picture in the textbook gave you the platform to share a little bit with your class.
Yeah, that's the only time. And we only spent just a short period of time on it, and only in one class. It was an AP class, advanced placement class.
Where were the schools that you taught?
Chula Vista High School.
Yeah.
And Hilltop High School.
Uh-huh.
I coached track and field. The best kids I ever had were the cross-country kids. Those kids were something.
So all those years, you didn't share your own personal story, but you kept running, like you said. You're obviously still in great shape. So it was just a few years ago that you started this annual tradition? How old were you when you did that first commemorative jump?
In the 91, 92.
Uh-huh.
Haven't been doing it too long. But
yeah. But so for the last 3 years, every June 6th, you go up in a tandem jump and skydive.
See, I don't want to compromise this knee. This knee has been replaced.
What do you get from that when it's June 6th, a day that you experienced from start to finish, that guys just like you were killed fighting that day, and you jump out of that airplane to skydive and then parachute to the ground? What do you think of? What's the significance of that?
Well, the idea is to honor those guys as best I can, and that's the only way I can do it. For what they did, those that were captured, killed, wounded, whatever. A couple of them in Fort Rosecrans that I know.
That's the
I don't go methodically through the whole process. It's a compounded thrill that's part of my risk nature to free fall 9,000 feet, mm-hmm. you know. So I'm enjoying this thing like mad. I'm posing for the photographer.
Yeah.
You didn't see the picture.
I did. Two thumbs up.
Yeah, yeah.
You're, and I'll put this picture on hometownheroesradio.com on the Facebook page, but here you are skydiving. I can see the wind resistance on you, and you've got both arms out with two thumbs up.
Yeah. We're having a great time.
I can tell you're having a great time, but you're also drawing attention to those who didn't come home.
Then part of the idea is to draw as much attention publicity-wise, although I didn't think of that at the moment, but that's what's happened. I am telling you, everything has broken open on top of me in publicity. And I keep telling Brenda, when is this going to stop? I can settle down to being a human being.
Well, thanks for letting me intrude your privacy here today. So the United States Parachute Association, the president, jumps with you every June 6th.
Every June 6th, yeah. He comes in from Arizona, and we make a tandem jump. And he gives me the controls when I get down to about 4,000 feet, and I fool around, and then he takes them over at 3,000 feet. I said, let's do some nosedive things. Let's do some stunts and things up there, but I'm not sure he's too anxious about that. In the plane that we went up on last time, there was a squirrel, a guy with a canvas between his arms.
One of those? Yeah, those squirrels.
Between his legs.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't get to see him because he was the last guy out, and I was falling free then. I'd like to have seen him, but Brenda,
something tells me you'd like to do it. You'd like to be the squirrel.
Yeah.
Is there a thrill out there that you haven't achieved yet that you're waiting for?
I pegged my livelihood to 101.
Okay.
101 airborne.
You want to go like a screaming eagle,
Yeah. The guys have got a formula where they're going to use an old World War II helmet, and in it is going to be some kind of a liquor concoction that's going to knock you off your feet if you stand on a ladder 6 feet tall. And the last guy in the regiment who is still alive is going to have to drink that concoction and jump off of that 6 foot ladder. I'm not looking to that one. But
I think you might have a good shot of drinking out of that helmet.
Oh, I don't want to do that. I don't. I'm not. I don't drink.
Uh huh.
I never drunk. Never smoked. Whatever. Maybe that's why I'm that old.
I think that's why you're that young. Yeah. Well, one thing I want to make sure I say is, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story, and thank you for keeping the memory of your fellow airborne troops and World War II veterans in general in the consciousness, in mind. What would you say you're most proud of and most thankful for?
The support that the society has given me, the protection. You grow up in this city, this is a paradise to grow up in. The opportunities placed before me on so many different occasions. My gravesite is already sitting in Fort Rosecrans. I know where it is.
You know what kind of view you're going to have.
Yeah,
huh?
Number 325 in Columbarium 3A. So a democracy allows for all freedom of expression, etc. I got fed up with teaching about the activities of human beings as congressmen and all their corruptibility. So I began to move toward the theoretical in constitution building. And so I recall to these kids all of their gifts that they have been given in the Bill of Rights. There were 22 of them at first. Then they went down to 12, and now they're 10. And I like to appoint all of those things, freedom of speech, press, assembly, petition. So you can understand this, Joe. You've got hands. You can choose any occupation you want as long as it's legal. And so you've got feet. You can move around this country anytime you want. There's no borderline police stopping you going into Arizona. I appointed ideas about each one of those things so they could really understand what they're getting into and what opportunities are placed before them.
Well, and it hit me that you spent all those decades teaching these impressionable young minds about the Bill of Rights and about all the freedoms that they enjoy in this country, and they never knew how big a price you paid personally to secure those freedoms.
Yeah. This last year and a half, all of this stuff has come down on me. They're not giving me a chance to rest. I just came back from Belgium.
Yeah, how was that? What did you get out of that?
Fantastic trip. The greatest generation took 21 of us. from the United States. And we came together in Washington, D.C. And we were going to go to the Battle of the Bulge. We were going to survey again the northern corridor of that entire bulge area. Mm-hmm. The places that the Germans had occupied. And we yo-yoed out of Luxembourg every day in a different direction. France, Germany, Holland, Luxembourg, and Belgium. All of those countries we yo-yoed out all around the Battle of the Bulge area. We went into Bastogne, and I noticed right on the right side there is the same old cemetery that I saw in 1944. Now it's covered with snow, and it looks really eerie. They threatened to kill me in Bastogne in 1944. Now what's going to happen in 2014? They damn near killed me again, because I came down with pneumonia later. Anyway, all the people in the city came in. They had pictures for us to sign. They wanted to talk to us. We marched up the hill to Bastogne to McAuliffe Square, where there's a big tank with a big shell hole in it. And so here we are, thousands and thousands of people just around that square. We're waiting for the King and Queen of Belgium. They came through with an entourage of military officers, so many stars that you couldn't count them. It looks like you're looking into the heavens. We're all in our red jackets. I told these guys, let's not call them red jackets. Let's call them the Red Badge of Courage. They liked that.
Well, it's fitting.
Yeah. The King and Queen came by, shaking hands with all of us red jacketed guys. I took her hand and I kissed it.
You kissed the Queen of Belgium's hand.
Yeah. I didn't know whether that was protocol or not, but she got her hand kissed. That was it. That's too bad.
And I'm sure you saw that what you did is not forgotten there.
Oh, yeah.
That they can't imagine their lives without the sacrifice that you guys made. That had to be pretty emotional for you.
Yeah, oh, yeah, it was.
You mentioned Louis Zamperini and that you were acquainted with him. So maybe you can tell me a little bit about how you became acquaintances.
I kind of followed his background when I was coaching and made it a point to tell these kids about him. And then, lo and behold, I met him up in Wood Lake. It's up there by...
Wood Lake.
Yeah, it's up there.
It's in Tulare County.
Yeah.
It's right by Exeter and Visalia. I know a glider pilot who flew on June 6th who owns the hardware store in Wood Lake.
Be darned.
Yep. So you met Louis Zamperini in Wood Lake?
Up there, yeah.
He was doing a camp or something?
He was making a speech.
Uh-huh.
I met him when he made the speech, and afterwards had a long talk afterwards, and our focus was running, because he was telling me about his running, and I was telling him about I was coaching and doing this and that. It got to be a great big bubble of information that was really a tremendous thing to have. I was three things. I was a soldier, I was an athlete, and I was a teacher. Those three things.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of it didn't matter too much.
Well, it sounds like you did a pretty good job at all three of those.
I kind of focus on those. And so today we focused on soldier.
And we're all better for it, aren't we? Tom Rice of Coronado, California. Check out his story on hometownheroesradio.com. And make sure you're back here next week at this very same time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you one more time that freedom is not free.